All right, well, here we go. Let's make some predictions here.
Okay, well...
5 years out.
Okay, 5 years out. And I have to clarify one thing. There's two separate worlds, and it's a little hard to predict how the two mix together. One world says this is what's technically feasible. The other world says this is what may be funded or politically acceptable or may not get brought to light because of some other set of reasons. So I'm going to try to focus just on the technical side because I think that if you try to mix into the politics and the sociodynamics and all that, it gets a little bit too diffuse.
Okay.
So I'm just going to try to focus on the technical side, and hopefully in most cases they turn out to be true. But I think in 5 years, let's just say that if we don't do this, it's going to be a bad scene. We really have to get energy out there on the road into the house in terms of hydrogen, in terms of alternative fuel systems. Solar for the home, I think, is very close. Several come. In fact, this month's issue of a magazine called Small Times, they have the top 10 nanotechnology breakthroughs of 2005, and one of them is one of my favorite companies called NanoSolar, and they are one of the manufacturers of this sort of organic solar voltaic materials that can be applied as a paint or as a printable material, and you'll see this in your stores like in a couple of years. So, I mean, sort of power for the home user, I think that's the big one, and perhaps power for the car in terms of solid-state hydrogen and, equally important, things like solid-state batteries that can replace our current lead-acid batteries, because that's one of the real problems with electric vehicles in general, is that the battery systems are still too dangerous and too heavy and too clunky, really, to be useful. But because, again, of changes in material systems, that whole sort of quadrant of the consumer energy world, that's where I think the next big target is. A few more years out, maybe 7 to 10 years, you're going to see radical breakthroughs in medicine. And by this, I mean the ability to have smart systems actually in the body. And we're going to be kind of I don't want to say cyborgs, it's probably a little too scary way of putting that. But certainly, I mean, right now, look, we have people with hip implants and with organ transplants and, all these sort of mix-and-match approaches to solve what had been unsolvable medical problems, say, 10 or 20 years ago. Well, just take it a step further. Pretty soon you're going to have diagnostics actually in the body. You're going to have artificially enhanced immune systems. You're going to have things like sensory systems, like eyes, sight and hearing and so forth.
What about nanos, Charles, that would clean out your arteries?
This is exactly one of the things that's really in the queue as you speak. In fact, one can go to Rutgers University and actually download a very interesting and very cool animation of just that, these little sort of nano, more like microscale really, but these little sort of microscale devices that go out and literally scoop the plaque out of your veins. And I mean, there's a huge interest in this kind of thing.
But how do you get them out once they start, once they do what they're supposed to do? How do you say, all right, let's get you out of the body now?
Well, the big deal here is to come up with a larger library of what are called biocompatible materials. And what that means is that materials that are not offensive to the body's immune system. So getting them out isn't necessarily a big deal or a big challenge. And in fact, the physics of this or the chemistry of this goes back, again, to the late 80s. A company now called BSI, or now called Surmodics, they were BSI, they filed the first patents on being able to, through a kind of a photonic bonding process, connect different kinds of organic molecules to the surface of your choice. It could be anything, metals, glass, plastic, whatever. But this was a big breakthrough because since this was a photonically driven process, people could then use masking technology that's currently used to make integrated circuits, but apply this same exact process to apply organic materials in very precise patterns to the thing of their choice. So a lot of the implants you're seeing now, the fact that they even work or are able to be applied is because of that kind of biocompatible chemistry application. And you're simply going to see more of it, but in ever more precise scale of deployment. So whether something stays in the body for a long time or it gets yanked out, that really depends on the application in question, but having to remove something is going to become less of an issue. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Let's look out 20 years from now, if you can.
Well, 20 years is where that consciousness stuff comes in. And excuse me, gosh, I'm so sorry. Basically, I think that we're sort of already there, but it's kept very quiet. But I think there will come a point where, as Ed Dames is saying, that this whole idea of remote influencing, yeah, it's a very real thing. I'm completely convinced this is going on now as you speak. So can we harvest the potential of remote influencing, not as a weapon, but as something that could really change the state of life and the state of our planet? That sounds kind of Pollyannish, but in fact, there's a thesis I was writing about some years ago that suggested that not only can living things be affected by this sort of empathic connectivity, as it were, but even systems that behave biologically could also be similarly affected. And this is where there might be kind of a debate raging. But if we're being immersed into a world where our global financial systems, our global resource management systems, are essentially the very heart of what makes everything kind of run, is based on these extremely elaborate, highly complex, and in many cases self-adapting sort of evolutionary computing-like paradigms, could those systems themselves be affected by some form of remote influence? And the answer is quite possibly. So I think that we're tapping into a region that says maybe the days of the gadgets and the physical contraptions become less relevant, and it's the power of our thought, the power of our intent, that becomes the driving force that kind of shapes our future. That threshold is visible, I would think, within 20 years.
How about 100 years out, Charles? And I mean, you know, we're taking you way out on this one.
That's okay. My thought would be as follows. If we get that far, maybe that's a way of
talking. Yeah, I agree with that.
But if we get that far, the day of the cyborg may, in fact, become what's next around the corner. And in fact, a number of people, of course, have talked about this. But what I mean is, you know, right now we're still kind of sloppy, messy organisms. We have a lot of problems with disease, and, you know, everybody's born a little bit different with certain attributes and detractions and so forth. And this may be a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not suggesting one way or the other. I'm just saying that there's a lot of pressures driving our economic decisions in today's world. And the number one driver, by the way, as I'm sure many people see it now, is the cost of health care. I mean, this is a serious issue, whether it's here in this country or in Europe or Japan or almost anywhere in the world. The cost of maintaining one's health is such a negative driver on the economy in question that people are desperately looking for ways to somehow get around this problem. So at some point, the pressure is going to be on to not just genetically modify our beings to these more homogenized being types, but to begin to really supplement, if you will, our functionality with all kinds of sort of quasi-mechanical accoutrement. That is, we become kind of emerging between a machine and an organic system. And certainly in the military, this is exactly where things will be going. In other words, the fighting soldier of the future may or may not be entirely human, and maybe the population falls in behind that.
Will these nanos be able to think for themselves, Charles?
Well, again, it's not so much nanos as independent things, but rather the nanofabrication process enables different kinds of systems and devices to be created in a much more robust way. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. I don't see nanos as becoming thinking things. But certainly, for instance, let's look at the idea of neural enhancement. The big deal right now is to look at how the brain works. I mean, the field of neurophysiology has moved ahead incredibly fast. I mean, just within the past 10 years now, we have very robust three-dimensional real-time imaging of exactly what parts of the brain fire under certain circumstances. We can extract from three-dimensional holographic sort of electrochemical events in the brain the kind of exposure that's happened, the kind of memories that a person has. I mean, we're moving very fast. And I would say that clearly within 10 to 12 years, we're going to be able to, in a sense, begin to enhance the brain's performance because we'll have such a precise map of what ganglia, what neural clusters do exactly what. We can begin to enhance those areas and maybe create people with super intellects and certain mental capacities. And this may or may not be dispensed to the general public. It may be restricted to a very select few and maybe become the new powerful people, if you will, or the new soldiers. In other words, there's a kind of a way of looking at this, but again, it's not so much what the technology is, it's really how it would be applied and what kind of is socio-politically acceptable. I think that's really going to be the boundary point as opposed to what's technically possible.